Lecture 22, End of the Cold War.
Imagine that the Cold War is ending now. It is 1991, 2 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Imagine that you are a former citizen of East Germany, or to use its formal title, the German Democratic Republic. Berlin became a whole city again as its division ended. The feared secret police of the East German state, the Stasi, have been dissolved. In 1990, you became a citizen of the Federal Republic of Germany. Events of the last few years have been a whirlwind for you, hard to absorb all at once. And now there's a new quandary. The Stasi, over the last decades, engaged in surveillance of East German society of unprecedented intensity and thoroughness, in part by the use of informants at the workplace, school, church, bars, sports clubs, every conceivable setting. The Stasi files survive. The file on you survives. New legislation will allow people to look inside their files, to read them. Should you look in your file? Will you discover who informed on you? A friend? Maybe a relative? Will you discover something that will shatter all that you thought you knew and make you completely rethink all your life? When the Cold War ended, it was a cause for celebration, and it was an incredible massive intelligence failure. The collapse of the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc in Eastern Europe by 1991 was not predicted by intelligence agencies in the West. After the billions that had been spent on gathering of information, intelligence, analysis, and its careful interpretation, the implosion of one of the parties of the Cold War had not been foreseen. Now, later, the CIA and other agencies would claim that they had indeed pointed to economic problems in the Soviet Union, but they had not predicted a massive upheaval and implosion of the sort that actually took place. The failure to foresee such a large event, however, was not exclusive to intelligence agencies. The universities of the United States and Europe were full of specialists in what was called at the time Sovietology, whose intellectual calling was to interpret this closed society, this riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, as Churchill had once called Russia. Political scientists analyzed and modeled the Soviet structure and society. All of them, however, missed what was coming. Only a handful of Eastern European dissidents, who seemed to contemporaries to be wildly off the mark, engaged in the most sort of wishful thinking. Only a few predicted that communism would collapse. They seemed to be dreaming an impossible dream. How do we explain this intelligence failure? To begin with, we need to take stock of what the Soviet Union and other communist states looked like by the 1980s. Long after World War II, the Soviet Union remained a very highly militarized society, with uniforms, a constant presence in the streets, and military training in the schools. I myself remember from visits to the Soviet Union in the late 1970s and in 1989 being struck by the number of uniformed people in the streets, especially many officers in Moscow. But at the same time that the Soviet Union was militarily strong, in other sectors it was underdeveloped. Some observers at the time who were clued into this disjuncture called the Soviet Union, quote, upper Volta with rockets, end quote. I should explain here that Upper Volta is the African country which now is known as Burkina Faso, so the implication of this saying was that the Soviet Union was a heavily armed but underdeveloped country. The Soviet command economy was certainly capable of maintaining huge conventional and nuclear forces, but was unable to keep up the standard of living for its citizens. Economic production was beset by distortions, shortages of essential goods like toilet paper, rationing, and on-the-job drunkenness and industrial accidents. The paradox was an especially sharp one. This planned economy, as it was called, relied on statistics for scientific planning. But statistics in the Soviet Union were routinely and at all levels distorted and exaggerated to show tremendous progress towards the final goal of full communism. In fact, the Soviet Union was stagnating, something that the statistics hid. There was a joke, in fact, current inside the Soviet Union about the Soviet Union as if it were a train. Stalin, it was said, had suspected the train driver of being a spy and thus had him shot, and the train stopped moving. Then, a later Soviet leader, Khrushchev, rehabilitated the driver. So now the driver was declared innocent, but he was still dead, and the train still wasn't moving. Finally, a late Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, was said to have told everybody on the train to pull down the shades and to sway from side to side so that everyone would pretend that the train was moving. Clearly, something had been lost. There was a loss of ideological momentum or fervor of the kind that had once propelled Stalin's purges. A ruling class had emerged in the Soviet Union, the privileged nomenklatura, as it was called. People who had special access to stores, only for them, elite schools for their children, and visits to the West, things that were not accessible to ordinary Soviet citizens. Dissidents were now not liquidated with a shot to the back of the head, as during Stalin, but instead were marginalized by losing their jobs, were harassed by police surveillance, or, if they were especially troublesome, were quelled by being institutionalized in psychiatric hospitals. And there was also a sense of fear. I remember in the 1970s visiting Lithuania, which then was under Soviet rule, and talking to people. When a sensitive topic would come up, one of two things would happen. It might be that the conversation was stopped and then would be restarted later outside on a park bench or strolling through nature away from suspected microphones. Alternatively, a pillow or a cushion might be placed on the telephone and the conversation continued in hushed tones inside. Ordinary people were convinced that the state could listen to them at will. Now, obviously, bugging the homes of millions of people would be technically very challenging. To me, the very belief that people had that it was possible and probable was a chilling thing. In 1982, after Brezhnev had died, the general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was chosen to replace him. Not elected, but chosen. This successor was Yuri Andropov. Andropov had the most powerful credentials. From 1967 to 1982, Andropov had been the chief of the KGB. Some argued that Andropov would be an especially effective leader because if anybody knew what was going on in the Soviet Union, it must be the KGB. As it turns out, however, even the KGB found itself living in a Potemkin village. I should explain that a Potemkin village was sort of a facade erected by a nobleman by the name of Potemkin in the days of Empress Catherine the Great of Russia, which was meant to hide the reality. It was a show in place of reality. There was, however, one regime allied with the Soviet Union, indeed the Soviet Union was its patron, that held especially high hopes of progress. That was the German Democratic Republic, known popularly as East Germany. I always tell my students that it's a very bad sign when a country has to include the word democratic in its name. If you have to say it, you're probably not. A common saying of the time was that if anyone could make the system of communism work, it would be the Germans. After all, Karl Marx had been a German. The GDR was an experimental society in terms of the intensity with which the secret police of the Ministry for State Security, the Stasi for short, monitored the citizens of the state. At the same time, the Stasi also had another role. They played a key role in international espionage. And this is one of the themes of our course, in which we've looked at both external and internal spying as parts of secret activities. The Stasi called themselves the sword and shield of the party. That title should sound familiar. It was also the title of the CK, which had been set up in the early days of the Bolshevik dictatorship by Felix Dzerzhinsky. Many Stasi officers had been trained by their KGB counterparts. Many felt a dual loyalty to the Soviets as their big brothers, as patrons. And indeed, many Stasi saw themselves in a direct line of descent from the fearsome CK to their own ranks. The jocular nickname that the Stasi had for themselves, oddly enough, was the Firm. And I'm struck by what an odd use of business metaphors one has here. Consider similarly that in the United States, the CIA has been nicknamed the company. Does all of this use of business metaphors harken back to the role of merchants as gatherers of intelligence in pre-modern societies, which we discussed in our earliest lectures? One man dominated the Stasi as its boss from 1957 all the way until the collapse of the regime itself in 1989. That was Erich Mielke. He was born to a working-class family in Berlin in 1907, became an early member of the young German Communist Party, and in 1931 had to flee to the Soviet Union after having killed two policemen in Berlin in riots. After World War II, he would return with the Red Army in order to set up a communist government in East Germany in the Soviet zone of occupation. The Stasi's other role, the role of foreign spying, was run by its section Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung, or Chief Section Intelligence, under Marcus Wolf, who was in this position for 34 years. Marcus Wolf was famous for being unknown. What a delicious irony. Somebody who's famous because of his obscurity. Indeed, Wolf was called the man without a face, because Western intelligence agencies didn't even know what he looked like for many years, and only finally got a photograph of him in 1978. The HVA has been called a first-class foreign intelligence organization. It was responsible for 80% of all of the spying done by non-Soviet forces in Eastern Europe. And in fact, the HVA, the East German Foreign Spying Section, was used by the KGB, which often subcontracted tasks to it. In fact, one of the KGB officers who was sent in this period to Germany to be a liaison and to coordinate cooperation of these fraternal security services was none other than Vladimir Putin, the current leader in Russia. Putin, it's said, can speak very good German. And if so, that would be a legacy of his days as a KGB officer in Dresden, East Germany. Of the tasks assigned to the Stasi in foreign terms, the most important was spying on the other Germany next door, West Germany. The Stasi infiltrated spies into many levels of government and industry in the Federal Republic. The most spectacular case was out of a husband-wife team, Gunther and Christel Guillaume. They were recruited by the Stasi, which used Gunther's Nazi past as a way of blackmailing him and putting pressure on him to become an agent. The couple traveled west, joined the Social Democratic Party, and Christel worked as a secretary in the office of the German Chancellor, Willy Brandt. Gunther befriended Brandt as well and became his great confidant, a trusted friend, a sounding board. But when Gunther was unmasked in 1974, Chancellor Brandt had to resign. This is a key example of a theme that we've stressed over and over in our course, the way in which the great public politics out in the open has often been shifted by the shadowy actions of espionage. Other infiltrations were so-called Romeo operations, and these became a notorious specialty of the Stasi. In tradecraft, a so-called honeypot plan is when sex is used to entice and entrap a target. In the Romeo operations, a variation on the honeypot plan, female secretaries in West Germany were targeted by East German male agents. Tragedies, personal tragedies ensued here, as in the case of a secretary in the West German Foreign Ministry who killed herself when she learned that her husband had only married her for the secrets he could gain access to through her. The Stasi also maintained links with international terrorist organizations that were so active in the 1970s and 1980s. Internally, the Stasi also played a key role in spying and repression of the citizens of the German Democratic Republic. The Stasi was not, as historians today point out, an all-powerful organization. But the fact that the population feared the Stasi and believed that it could be ever-present was a powerful thing. Perception can matter even more than reality in history, and this is a classic case. Stasi border troops guarded the wall with orders to shoot to kill, because flight from the Republic, as it was called, was a crime. Dissidents were kept under surveillance. Stasi stool pigeons in their midst spied on them secretly. Friends reported on friends. Spouses informed on spouses, and parents spied on their children. The Stasi also perfected a strange way of tracking dissidents. When brought in for interrogations, dissidents sometimes were made to sit on chairs with special removable cloth seats. After a person sat for 10 minutes in the hot seat, the cloth seats would be removed and they would produce samples of the individual scent of that person, which were kept in bottles at Stasi headquarters for future use. This sounds incredible. It sounds like an urban legend. But in fact, this was part of a venture that the Stasi seriously undertook in smell science or odorology. Now, let it be noted that this was a technique that wasn't invented by the Stasi. It actually predated the East German regime. And it had first been initiated in criminal investigations to analyze crime scenes using those unequaled smell analysts' dogs. What the Stasi did was to take this technique from the world of crime solving and to turn it to political uses. They would use these scents to track or identify people who might have put up protest posters, or who had distributed leaflets, or who wrote graffiti, leaving their scent in the process and thus implicating them. There were massive numbers of Stasi employees, both open and secret, in this relatively small country of 16 million. And that makes this one of the most spied-on societies in history. In 1989, when the regime of East Germany fell, there were about 91,000 full-time officers, or one secret police officer for every 180 citizens. By comparison, in Nazi Germany, recall that 7,000 Gestapo officers worked on a far larger population. Similarly, the KGB was estimated to have about 500,000 employees near the end of the Soviet Union, with a much bigger population, with about one secret policeman for every 595 people. But in addition to these 91,000 full-time employees of the Stasi, also in 1989, the Stasi listed in addition 173,000 informers working secretly. Thus, in the last year of the regime, it's been estimated that there was one secret police employee for each 60 people. One scholar estimates that 2% of the adult population had a direct tie to the police. Other estimates go much higher. For instance, one former Stasi officer claimed that an eighth of the population had worked for the Stasi, and one-third at one time or other had had such a role. The Stasi and its work generated 111 miles of files on targets and maintained feared prisons like Hohenschönhausen in Berlin. A recent Oscar-winning film was made about Stasi surveillance, Lives of Others, of 2006, by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. In this film, a Stasi official bugging a composer becomes converted to the opposition because of what he hears, or gains sympathies for the opposition. It's been pointed out that this is a beautiful story and a powerful film, but there's no instance of something like this actually having happened. Instead, let me mention two cases that can stand in for many others of betrayal by people close to their victims. A woman who today is a German politician, Vera Lengsfeld, was punished by the East German state for her opposition. And then after the regime collapsed, she had a terrible shock. She discovered from her files that her own husband had been spying on her. In another case, a man named Jürgen, who'd been a hippie in the 1970s, had been sent to jail for protesting the exile of a political dissident songwriter by putting up posters. He had been betrayed, as he later found out after the wall came down, by his best friend and fellow band member. Years after, Jürgen confronted his betrayer at his home. What was the man's reply? The betrayer claimed that he had actually all along been protecting Jürgen against Jürgen's own weaknesses. Isn't this the alibi of so many repressive police forces worldwide? They never met again. A powerful impetus for change came from what might be called the Polish Revolution of 1980, nonviolent, in a sense an internal, psychological revolution. It was a clear challenge to the orthodoxy represented by the communist state, when in August 1980, Polish workers in the Gdansk shipyard formed an independent trade union, Solidarity. Tapping into old and very deep Polish romantic traditions of underground organizing, Polish society responded eagerly. This was also reinforced by excitement over the election in 1978 of a new Polish pope, John Paul II. The slogans of the Polish resistance were, "Act as if you are free." Being not afraid of the state, the secret police, or the authorities, feeling an internal freedom. Heading towards the end of the Cold War, the year 1985 was a pivotal year. Let me mention four events, all in 1985, that proved to be significant taken in tandem. First, in 1985, a new leader was selected in the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev. He announced programs intended to reform the Soviet Union and make communism work effectively. This was to include a lessening of tensions with the West and reducing Soviet overextension in satellite states. The second event of 1985 was the entanglement of the Reagan administration and the CIA in the so-called Iran-Contra affair. Ronald Reagan had been elected in 1980 with George Herbert Walker Bush, the former director of the CIA, as his vice president. In 1985, a covert operation was enacted that, with Israeli intermediaries, secretly sold American weapons to Iran in spite of an embargo, and used funds from the sale to support the Contra anti-communist guerrilla fighters in Nicaragua, in spite of congressional legislation forbidding such support. When news broke of the program in 1986, Reagan said he had not known of the matter, but took responsibility. The controversy of the affair that followed took a further toll on the CIA. The third event of 1985 was in fact not one event, but a cascade of bad news for American intelligence. This led the year 1985 to be called the Year of the Spy in the United States. Three major cases were revealed that year. One of them we've discussed already in Lecture 20 on Jonathan Pollard, who passed naval intelligence to the Israelis. Another case was the Walker spy ring. Walker was a retired Navy officer who had recruited his brother, his son, and his best friend for espionage for the Soviet Union. Talk about keeping it in the family. Walker had been a Navy radio man who had access to code procedures. He contacted the Soviets secretly sometime around 1967 and passed them secrets. Walker retired from the Navy in 1976, but continued spying activities now through the ring he had organized. Walker had not been able to recruit his wife or his daughter who was in the Army. In fact, it was Mrs. Walker who called the FBI after the two divorced and wanted to turn in her husband. She was at first not believed. But in 1984, she renewed the charge, and in May of 1985, Walker was arrested by the FBI after he had put documents in a prearranged dead drop in Poolsville, Maryland. The final case that came to light in 1985 was Ronald Pelton, a National Security Agency analyst who had left his position in 1979, but retained, strangely enough, due to his photographic memory, vast information about his earlier job. Beset by debts and financial problems, in 1980, Pelton approached the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. to volunteer his services. He was a so-called walk-in, or volunteer. The FBI caught Pelton due to a tip-off from a Russian defector, and Pelton was indicted for espionage and convicted in 1986, sentenced to three life sentences. These sorry cases of the Year of the Spy were indicative of a larger trend. The spies of the 1930s and the 1940s, whom we discussed in earlier lectures, had been ideological in their motivations. Later spies and double agents, by contrast, seem to have been motivated by money or ego or a combination of the two, not by a fervent faith or conviction for communism. These cases, as it also turns out, were just the tip of the iceberg, because two other spies were active in 1985 as well, but not yet detected. They were Aldrich Ames, a CIA counterintelligence officer who spied for the Soviets, and then, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, for the Russians, for 9 years, and Robert P. Hansen, an FBI agent who also spied for the Soviets and then the Russians, who had been active for more than 20 years. These men betrayed secrets and agents so that their actions cost lives. We'll consider their activities and how they were caught in our next lecture. The fourth and last big event of 1985 for the history of covert operations actually came in fictional form. In 1985, in a televised news conference, President Ronald Reagan gave a boost to a new novel which had appeared the previous year, Tom Clancy's Hunt for Red October. Reagan praised it, calling it the perfect yarn, and saying that it was a thriller that could not be put down. In a strange way, politics and literature converged, as Reagan's recommendation helped turn the thriller into a bestseller. Recall that the same sort of thing had happened with JFK and with the early Bond novels. This helped launch Clancy's career for the next decades. In the novel, Hunt for Red October, a Soviet submarine captain who's become disenchanted with the Soviet Union wants to defect to the West and to bring his state-of-the-art submarine, the Red October, over to the Americans. The Soviet captain is helped by the CIA agent Jack Ryan. The submarine captain's name is Marco Ramius, and he's supposed to be Lithuanian, although I can say, as someone with Lithuanian background, that I've never met any Lithuanian named Marco or Ramius, but that's a small quibble. Sharing star billing with the other heroes of Clancy's novel is, in addition to the sub-captain and the CIA agent, is the technology. The experimental nuclear submarine, Red October, and the American vessels. Their technology is lovingly described and often takes the leading role. All of this was eloquent testimony in fictional form to the way in which technology and computers were moving into a key role in espionage and covert operations, a process which we're also going to explore a little bit more in our following lecture. Although not predicted by intelligence analysts, the fall of communism and the end of the Cold War happened, when it did, with breathtaking rapidity. This happened under the watch of President George Herbert Walker Bush, who had been elected in 1988. This was the first time in American politics that a former CIA director had become president. But there was a kind of presidential precedent. Recall from our lecture on the American War of Independence that George Washington had been a spy master, then president as well. So both Georges, in a sense, had the spy master background. In Eastern Europe, Gorbachev's reforms had launched a process that soon took on a dynamic of its own, escaping his control. As populations spurned their earlier fear of internal repression to start asserting themselves. In Germany, for instance, the Berlin Wall was toppled overnight in November 1989. The Soviet Union itself collapsed outright in 1991. And at long last, after decades, the Cold War came to a close. But the passing of these repressive regimes left legacies that would take longer to deal with and are still around today. In the former East Germany, the authorities responded with denial at first, as the system was crashing down around them. Speaking to the parliament 4 days after the wall had crashed down, the chief of repression, the Stasi chief Milke, pleaded, "But I love you all," ignoring the lives that had been damaged or destroyed by his security apparatus. Milke would never be put on trial for the actions of the Stasi or for the killings that had taken place at the wall as people tried to escape. After being convicted of killing two policemen in Berlin in the 1930s, decades previous, Milke served some months in jail before being freed for health reasons. He and many others were not called to account. To prevent the destruction of Stasi records and the secrets they told, dissidents in East Germany bravely stormed Stasi headquarters. Today, those headquarters are a museum in Berlin, as is the feared prison in that city, Hohenschönhausen. If you're able to, I strongly recommend that you visit these places. It's uncanny to walk as a visitor along the corridors of the Stasi headquarters, to look in at Milke's office with his telephones to keep in touch with the KGB, to see the secret equipment which was used in spying on the population itself. But most impressive of all is to visit the prison museum and to hear the tour guides, who are former dissidents, who can tell you of how they personally were treated in these jails. While the Cold War, real as it had been, left painful legacies that continue to resonate today, the ending of the Cold War would pose serious challenges to the world of espionage as well, as the battle lines of that conflict faded, shifted, and as a new global scene emerged, a topic which we'll engage in our next lecture.